Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I'm going to say a few words about contemplation and charity in Thomas Aquinas, meaning and significance for today. I apologize to those who have a strong theological background. This paper is written for a broad audience, but hopefully there'll be something in it for everybody. The paper consists basically of two parts. The first part deals with contemplation, self-transcendence, intellect, and reason. You should have this handout in front of you. So, first of all, what is contemplation according to Thomas? Now, today we probably associate contemplation with prayer, or even see it as a part of prayer. But that's not really Thomas's view. For him, contemplation in general is the pursuit of truth, be it speculative, as in the philosophical or theological sciences, or in a more general vein, in the life of the Christian through faith. In the strict sense of the word, however, contemplation is deeply intellective. And I'll explain what that word means later. It has to do with insight and understanding, as distinct from discursive reasoning, ratio. So I'm going to try and unpack this. The distinction, the contrast between reason or ratio and insight, understanding or intellectus, occurs throughout the writings of Thomas. In Summa Theologiae, the first part, question 59, we read, for instance, the intellect knows by simple intuition, while reason knows by a process of discursion from one thing to another. So this is how Thomas describes the two distinct operations, the rational discursive and the intellective one. And that's your first quotation. I quote, "To understand is simply to apprehend intelligible truth, and to reason is to advance from one thing understood to another, so as to know an intelligible truth. And therefore angels, who according to their nature possess perfect knowledge of intelligible truth, have no need to advance from one thing to another, but they apprehend the truth simply and without mental discursion, as Dionysius says in the Divine Names. But we arrive at the knowledge of the intelligible truth by advancing from one thing to another, and therefore we are called rational. Reasoning, therefore, is compared to understanding as movement is to rest, or acquisition to possession, of which one belongs to the perfect, the other to the imperfect." Right, there's a number of points worthy of note. First of all, while human cognition is mainly rational discursive, it does have an intellective dimension. Discursive reasoning culminates in a moment of intellective understanding or insight, when the penny drops. It is what Germans call the Aha-Erlebnis, or in English, the light bulb moment, when you get it, right? That's an intellective moment of insight. Angels have an immediate and timeless insight, whereas we really have to go through a whole reasoning process to attain this kind of insight. So for us, intellectus, or insight, or understanding, comes at the end of a reasoning process. But also, certain insights can be the foundation, or have to be the foundation, of discursive reasoning. Thomas gives the example of principles such as the entirety, the whole, is larger than any of its constituent parts, or else the principle of non-contradiction. These are principles that you simply see. You don't have to reason about it. So for Thomas, human cognition is circular or even spiral. Our discursive reasoning processes cannot begin without assenting in an intellective manner to a number of principles or truths which we simply grasp without discursive reasoning. We see them. Even the very word insight is important. It has a visual connotation. We see something. And that's distinct from discursive reasoning, which indicates the word discursive means that it's a process that you have to run through. So we cannot even begin to reason about anything without key principles, such as the principle of non-contradiction. And again, our reasoning processes culminate and come to rest in an intellective understanding when we attain insight. That's why it's, you can call it a spiral. So my brief outline so far suggests that human rationality is inherently self-transcendent. As Dennis Turner says, and I have a quotation there on your handout, we could not be rational if we were not also more than rational. Human beings are not rational unless they are also intellectual. I would actually say intellective, but same meaning in the context. So human reason has a self-transcendent dynamic to it, which, as I suggested, comes to fruition in contemplation, in which the intellect takes central stage. As Thomas says, and that's your third quotation, when contemplating, discursive reasoning must be put aside, and the gaze of the soul must be fixed on the contemplation of one simple truth. So contemplation, in the words of the 20th century Thomas Joseph Pieper, is, I quote, a type of knowing which does not merely move towards its object, but rests in it. The object is present as a face or a landscape is present to the eye when the gaze rests upon it. This is a very brief outline, but I do think there are some interesting implications we can draw from this brief outline. First of all, in admittedly pretty general terms, modern philosophy, and more broadly, the modern secular worldview, is based upon the assumption that reason operates without presuppositions. This is what we mean when we say that reason is autonomous. If you're familiar with the Meditations by Descartes, the founder of modern philosophy, you will remember that he doubts everything in order to attain certainty. He refuses to assume anything. Universal doubt and skepticism are therefore the foundation, and we could say perhaps the mirror image, of universal and autonomous reason and certainty. But Aristotle and Thomas could have told Descartes that autonomous reason is a fiction. Whenever we reason, we do so on the basis of certain presuppositions or assumptions. Take logic, for instance, perhaps the most rational of human disciplines. But you cannot prove anything without accepting, in good faith, certain presuppositions or axioms, such as the principle of non-contradiction or the law of the excluded middle, P or not P. So scholars call this the fiduciary nature of rationality, which means that all rationality is based on principles we simply see or accept in an intellective manner, and without which we cannot even begin to reason in a coherent manner. Now, the modern secular worldview attempts to ban all assumptions from public discourse, including and especially, of course, religious ones. Yet it forgets that its own outlook relies on assumptions and presuppositions, even though they may not be religious ones, obviously. So instead of separating reason and beliefs or assumptions as such, we need to ask ourselves, which kind of beliefs are we assuming? It's the mark of a critical person, not that she reasons without assumptions, but that she's aware of her assumptions. And if it is the case that we all operate with beliefs and assumptions, I see no fundamental reason why beliefs, including religious ones, should a priori be banned from being employed in public debates. I'm just I'll leave it hanging here, and I won't develop this point here any further. But allow me to make a second observation, which I can only mention it in passing. It has been highlighted by Sean Steele in a paper on Bloom's taxonomy or classification of educational objectives. If you don't follow this point, it's not the end of the world, because it's not essential to the argument. But I wonder whether you're familiar with Bloom's taxonomy of learning objectives. Indirectly, you are, I'm sure. It has been introduced in almost all European universities. So it maps a hierarchy of learning objectives in terms of knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. Whenever I design a new module in my university, I have to make sure that these learning objectives are met in the module description. So in this module, you will learn to know this and analyze this and so on, right? But the problem is that all of this remains pretty much at the level of rational discursive reasoning, or what Steele calls the calculative subject-object knowing of ratio. It never reaches the level of receptive awareness or contemplative insight, where we gaze upon or contemplate in an intellective manner what we have learned. Another somewhat different way of putting this is that this taxonomy remains too much at the level of discursive knowledge, but it never reaches wisdom. The latter is completely absent from Bloom's taxonomy, and therefore does not figure in our modern pedagogical concerns. Obviously, I'm not suggesting that engaging with great literature of philosophy and theology cannot yield opportunities for contemplative insight and wisdom. Of course they do, but they're not captured in our learning objectives and taxonomies. They're, so to speak, extracurricular. I've mentioned that the life of contemplation concerns a receptive approach to reality, independent of the practical aims that characterize its counterpart, which we call the active life. Contemplation is pursued for its own sake and is not subject to any other goal. Contemplation, such as when we study the writings of a great theologian or philosopher, is inherently non-calculative or non-instrumentalist. We pursue it for its own sake, because it's meaningful in its own right, and not for any other reason. This is why Thomas writes that contemplation consists in a certain liberty of mind, in leisure and rest. He quotes Psalm 46, "Be still and see that I am God." Contemplation, as an end in itself, is therefore diametrically opposed to instrumentalization, whereby we treat something that is valuable in its own right as a means to the benefits it confers. This is, by the way, why we speak of the liberal arts, namely because they're not subservient to something else. We pursue truth and insight for their own sakes. So this leads to a third observation, which I think is a fairly countercultural one, but a fundamental one, because it concerns what life is ultimately about. Namely this, the claim that contemplation is inherently more meaningful than the practical life. Practical life which is concerned with doing things in the world. Thomas argues that the practical life is fulfilled in the contemplative life. A quotation again from Thomas, which unfortunately I did not include on your page. The contemplative life is loved more for its own sake, while the active life is directed towards something else, and that something else is effectively contemplation. Now, given our modern preference for things practical, this view may strike readers from the 21st century as elitist and perhaps even unchristian. My own students are often taken aback when I explain this. Surely, they object, life is about helping others rather than about contemplating truth for its own sake. But I think Thomas's point is a perfectly plausible one. After all, the purpose of acts of charity cannot lie within themselves. The alleviation of suffering, no matter how important and urgent, and that is not being disputed, but the alleviation of suffering is only a means to an end. It creates the conditions in which other people can enjoy a fulfilling life of pursuit and dwelling in the presence of truth, which is a contemplative life. I mean, think about it. If the ultimate meaning of life resided in doing charitable works and in the alleviation of the suffering of others, I would actually need other people to be in need for my life to have meaning. And that sounds decidedly odd. Or again, from a Christian point of view, heaven, in which all our practical needs will be fulfilled, would then be a place of absurdity and meaninglessness. So, in short, a life of active virtue points to something beyond itself. The active life is necessary and is meaningful, but its meaning is to make possible the happiness of contemplation. And it becomes meaningless the moment it sees itself as an end in itself. Now, as I've alluded to, the fact that the contemplative life is inherently more meaningful than the active life does not mean that at times the urgencies of the active life should not take precedence over contemplation. But Thomas says, in a restricted sense, and in a particular case, one should prefer the active life on account of the needs of the present life. And even when we engage in charitable activity, on the other hand, we should attempt to retain a contemplative dimension to this activity. Again, I think this is a countercultural insight. Nietzsche, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, says that he no longer knows the bliss of those who can receive. And Heidegger, in turn, added, this inability to receive and the accompanying drive to produce is one of the hallmarks of our modern technological age. But Thomas and the pre-modern tradition claim that our fulfillment cannot be found primarily in producing and getting things done, but rather in receiving and in contemplation. And I think that's right. Are not our deepest moments in life those where we receive, such as when we encounter and receive beauty and friendship and love, rather than when we are busily doing things? Okay, this brings me to the end of the first part of the paper on contemplation and self-transcendence. The second part deals with Christian love, gratuitousness, and self-transcendence. So far, I have briefly sketched the nature of contemplation, its self-transcendent character, and the fact that it is something to be pursued in its own right. Now, at this stage, some of you might perhaps be rather concerned that Thomas's account of contemplation is excessively intellectual. You may be wondering, is there no connection with the will, or with love, or with desire, or with affection? Now, it is undoubtedly the case that Thomas does put a strong emphasis on the intellective nature of contemplation, in contrast, for instance, with some of his Franciscan counterparts. But still, even for Thomas, our intellectual engagements are at least partly shaped and driven by our desires, interests, and preferences. Or again, if we attain an insight into a complex issue, there's an element of delight and joy, which has to do with the will and affection rather than the intellect. So there are connections between, obviously, contemplation and the will. But there's another one that I want to highlight. As I've tried to explain, contemplation is something we pursue in its own right. But profound love, of course, should also be pursued for its own sake. And this is the connection I want to look at in what follows. Basically, I want to suggest that charity, or love for God, instills in us a disposition of gratuitousness or non-instrumentalization in our dealings with God, others, and the world. From Augustine onwards, Latin theologians have argued that by anchoring our lives in the mystery of God as our ultimate concern, we refrain from either idolizing a particular finite thing in the world or from discarding it with tedium and boredom. Love for God ideally, instills in us a non-possessive, non-instrumentalist or gratuitous disposition in our dealings with the world. So that's the claim, and I'll try and explain this. So in the first part, I've said there is some sort of self-transcendence of the of human cognition. Ratio becomes intellect. Similarly, there is a sort of self-transcendence at work in terms of will and love. So let me try and explain this. And in order to do so, obviously, I need to focus on what Thomas says about charity and how it transforms our relations with others and even ourselves. Right. So Thomas describes charity as friendship for God. In a post-Christian era, charity is often understood in terms of assisting our fellow human beings. But according to Thomas, charity refers in the first place to our love for God, while love of neighbor is an extension of that love for God. Now, Thomas argues that charity, and this is the important bit, reroots, so to say, the way we relate to others, the world, and ourselves. In charity, or love for God, we do not immediately love others, but we love them for God's sake, through God as the intermediary, so to say. We can call this, and scholars have called this, the triangular nature of charity. And I made two little drawings there at the bottom of your page just to illustrate it. This triangular nature of love explains, for instance, why we can love our enemies. Aside from the fact that we can love our enemies insofar as they are human, it is pretty impossible, says Thomas, to directly love our enemies. It's an extraordinary statement to make. It's not the sort of statement you expect from a Christian theologian. It says it is perverse. Strong language. It is perverse if you claim that you can directly love your enemy. Why is it perverse? Well, because we thoroughly dislike our enemies and presumably they dislike us. So don't claim that you love them, right? So directly loving your enemy doesn't work. We can, however, says Thomas, begin to love them when we know that they too are loved by God. That is, when the way we relate to them is mediated through God. Thomas gives the example of children who commit wrong against us. If we realize that they are the children of a good friend of ours, this will modify the way we relate to them. We might, for instance, be less vindictive and more forgiving. So the fact that we know that they are loved by God changes the way we relate to them. I note in passing that Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher and theologian, also characterizes charity in triangular terms. Kierkegaard wrote, and that's a quotation you have on your page, Kierkegaard wrote that God is always the middle term in our relations with others. Worldly wisdom, he says, is of the opinion that love is a relationship between persons. Christianity teaches that love is a relationship between a person, God, a person. That is, that God is the middle term. To love God is to love oneself truly. To help another person to love God is to love another person. To be helped by another person to love God is to be loved. I have claimed that when God is our ultimate concern in everything we do or desire, Augustine calls it the fruition of God, this will transform the way we relate to the world, others, and ourselves. But I still need to explain this in more detail. First of all, let us observe that our will has an almost infinite dynamic to it. It seems hardly ever satisfied. In the words of St. Augustine, which you all know, addressing God in his book Confessions, our heart are made unto you, and they are restless until they find their rest in you. Something that we can all recognize. Now, willing or loving is inherently intentional. When we desire or love, we are inherently intent upon something. You cannot just want or will in an objectless way. Same actually applies to thinking. Now, the will of the human beings, if they are not religious, almost inevitably latches on, so to speak, to created things. Power, prestige, money, pleasure, the nation, the football team. And none of these created things can bear the infinite dynamic of our will. So we're in danger of idolizing something created. And the definition of an idol, as you know, is a false god. So if we treat something finite or created as a god, as our ultimate concern in life, we risk becoming enslaved to it. And there are plenty of sad examples. The politician obsessed with the pursuit of power at all costs. The miser, the extreme nationalist, the football fanatic. It is exactly because God is not part of created things that he cannot be manipulated by our riotous desires and agendas. But if God, being beyond this world, cannot be manipulated, he cannot enslave us either. The way created things can be a source of addiction, such as power, money, pleasure, and so on. Again, I think this is a countercultural insight. The popular view is that religion is a source of oppression and denial of the world. Think of Nietzsche, and should be best done away with. I'm suggesting, in contrast, that genuine religiosity can be a source of freedom and fulfillment, if only because it keeps us from being enslaved by the idols we create. In knowing and loving God first and foremost, we refrain from treating something created as our ultimate end, an attachment that usually ends in tedium, subjection, or disenchantment, for all things created are finite and transient. So I'm suggesting that through through charity or a radical theocentric focus, we can come to cultivate a non-instrumentalist, gratuitous disposition that spills over into our relations with all things created. Now, the medieval tradition offers profoundly rich resources, not just in scholastic theology such as Thomas's, but equally so in spiritual writings of authors, men and women, such as Bernard of Clairvaux, Hardwig, Beguin, Meister Eckhart, Rusbrook, to name but a few. Their key insight is that our will needs to relate to the mystery of God in an utterly gratuitous, non-instrumentalist manner, because true love is always its own reason. Through a radical theocentric focus, we attain a disposition which they call detachment or self-forgetfulness, which by its very nature of non-self-centeredness allows us to engage with the world in a non-instrumentalist way. Thus, the radical theocentric focus makes us truly self-transcendent and focused upon the mystery that grounds our being, but that we can never grasp, no matter how much we desire union with it. This self-transcendence both assumes and strengthens a gratuitous, non-instrumentalist disposition, allowing us to treat things and others with respect and reverence. Okay, perhaps all of this sounds too theoretical. So let me give you a concrete example of gratuitousness and how it contrasts with an instrumentalist approach. This is a very homely example. Imagine that you're at work, at a work-related social event. Coming up to Christmas, I'm sure there's a few around. Now, you're good friends with one of your colleagues, call her Jane, and Jane asks you for a favor, such as, for instance, assistance with a tedious job that she has to do. Now, Jane is a friend of yours, and you agree to help her. Next, your colleague John comes along. Now, John tries to endear himself to you with a view to obtaining the same favor. Now, you're aware that John is using collegial relations to get something from you. In other words, he is instrumentalizing his relation with you. So, as I've said, people instrumentalize something, friendship, beauty, love, when they treat it not as valuable in its own right, but as a means to an end. That is, as a means to obtain the benefits that it indirectly confers. By directly targeting the advantages that come with friendship, John instrumentalizes it. Jane's case is different. She simply acts like a friend, and the advantages that accompany friendship are not her primary concern. So the difference between John and Jane is basically the difference between a social networker and a genuine friend. Now, okay, this is only an analogy, but I hope it's an apt one, because remember, Thomas understands charity in terms of friendship. So, having a look at your two little drawings there at the bottom of the page, it is only when we have friendship for God, first and foremost, God as our ultimate concern, and do not directly target created things and their benefits, that we can enjoy the latter without manipulating them or subjecting them to our own agenda. Thus, if in charity we are first and foremost friends with God, that is, if God is our ultimate concern throughout everything in life, we can relate to created things in a proper and reverent way, without idolizing them or abusing them, just like Jane relates properly to us without actually immediately targeting the advantages that come with friendship. I think this is an insight of importance, especially when faced with problems caused by our abuse of the natural world and the present climate crisis. It seems to me, and I conclude with this, it seems to me that medieval insights on contemplation as receptive, on the gratuitousness of self-transcendent love, and the insight that what is most important in life is often received and eludes us if we directly target it, those insights remain rich and are countercultural resources, I think, for today's outlook on the world. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.